All right, welcome to Indie Media On Air. That was Zounds with Subvert. That came out in 1980 on Crass Records. Today's show, we are going to be talking with the South Central farmers and what's going on in their case and how they're fighting to preserve a piece of land that locals in the area are growing food on. We will also be talking to a member of the 33 and a third bookstore collective in Echo Park, which is facing the effects of gentrification. And we will also be hearing a talk, or a part of a talk, of the recent Naomi Klein speech here in Los Angeles. And she talks about Iraq and the aftermath of the elections. But before we get into that, I'm going to have some indie media headlines for you. This is from indiemedia.us via New York City IMC. Judge tosses out latest New York City indie media subpoena. In an important victory for indie media and other radical journalists, a U.S. District Court judge has quashed the latest in a string of subpoenas received by the New York City Independent Media Center. The subpoena from the City Law Department arose from a civil suit in which New York City is a defendant. In it, the city demanded voluminous information, including all the IMC's news reporting, emails, and web pages relating to the 2002 World Economic Forum. The city subpoenaed a number of different organizations, including the National Lawyers Guild, in an attempt to determine who organized an Animal and Earth Liberation March. New York City IMC made three arguments in seeking to quash the subpoena. First, that the material sought was largely irrelevant to the case. Second, that the city of New York could obtain the information it sought just as easily on the NYC IMC. And third, that the First Amendment reporter's privilege protected the NYC IMC. The U.S. District Court judge agreed with New York City IMC that the material was of marginal relevance and also that the material was publicly available and thus obtainable by the city. While the judge did not directly address the question of reporter's privilege, neither did he dismiss the argument outright. All but one of the other subpoenas were also quashed. For more on the story, please visit indiemedia.us. And it's actually, there's been a lot of legal harassment of IMC centers, not just in the U.S. but around the world, and we're trying to pay attention to them and support those that are under the pressure of these frivolous lawsuits attacking independent journalists. So please visit nyc.indiemedia.org for more information. This from indiemedia.us via Houston. Less than lethal kills Houston man. Tasers and law enforcement. The use of tasers by law enforcement has come under scrutiny recently across the United States. According to the manufacturer of Taser International, Taser devices utilize compressed nitrogen to project two small probes up to 25 feet at a speed of over 160 feet per second. These probes are connected to the Taser device by insulated wire. An electrical signal is transmitted through the wires to where the probes make contact with the body or clothing, resulting in an immediate loss of the person's neuromuscular control and the ability to perform coordinated action for the duration of the impulse, a 50,000-volt shock. The Taser International also points out that Taser devices are currently in testing or use at over 6,000 law enforcement, military, or correctional agencies in the United States and abroad. Taser International claims these devices are completely safe, and many have grouped Tasers with a host of new weapons described as less than lethal. This classification is obviously untrue. On Friday, February 18th, Houston Police Department tasered a 50-year-old man multiple times, which resulted in his death soon after in a local hospital. There has been a call for an emergency protest today, Monday, February 28th at 4:30 p.m., at the Harris County Criminal Justice Center, 1201 Franklin Street downtown. A report by Amnesty International declares that more than 70 people have died in police custody in the United States and Canada since June of 2001 after being struck with tasers in police custody. In response to this killing by HPD, the Texas ACLU has called for a moratorium on the use of tasers by more than 300 agencies that use these electric stun guns statewide. At the January 20th anti-inauguration protest in Austin, police used a taser on one protester as they violently arrested three people. This police brutality has resulted in a campaign against the police use of tasers in Austin, and I should add countrywide, and a protest at APD headquarters early this month. For more information, please visit indymedia.us. And this from indymedia.us. 74-year-old American missionary sister Dorothy Stang was assassinated on Saturday, February 12th, in the Amazon state of Pará, Brazil. Sister Dorothy was traveling to a sustainable development project in Anapu with some colleagues when she was shot three times by two gunmen. This tragedy occurred 16 years after the murder of Chico Mendes, who was also a defender of rural communities. Mendes was also a colleague of the current Minister for the Environment, Marina Silva. Marina Silva is in Anapu meeting with state authorities following the news of Sister Dorothy's death. Like Chico Mendes, Sister Dorothy refused to be intimidated, and she paid an enormous price, said Paulo Adario, Greenpeace Amazon coordinator. She selflessly worked for many years supporting the rights of rural workers and defending the Amazon from reckless deforestation, and we can't let her death be in vain. Originally from Dayton, Ohio, U.S. Sister Dorothy was a Brazilian citizen and has worked in the Amazon for the past 37 years, living in Anapu since 1972. For 56 years, she has been a member in good standing in the Congregation of the Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur, an international Catholic religious order of approximately 2,000 women who work on five continents. She opposed land grabbers and illegal loggers who used intimidation, violence, and guns to force small landowners off their land. She worked in an area that is remote and lawless, and she has received many death threats. She has been on a death list for years, yet the state government of Pará has failed to protect her. She is not alone either, and there are many others fighting against the forest destruction and the rights of local communities whose lives are in danger, said Adario. The violence and intimidation must stop. We cannot accept more martyrs in the Amazon. Okay, that story can be found, and more information can be found on indymedia.us. Before we get into our show, there's something that I feel like I really need to say about the Oscars and the whole Hollywood spectacle, and this is really my opinion and not that of Indie Media per se or KPFK. And, you know, all due respect to the acting community, because I recognize that acting is very much an art form. But, you know, the Oscars are a spectacle, and they glorify wealth and privilege. And that yearly ritual that enforces the mythology of Camelot and essentially constitutes America's version of royalty. Is it any wonder that the right wing hypocritically uses Hollywood to demonize any politics that counter corporate interest? While many of the actors are conscious of this, the Hollywood system itself ensures that the distance between normal people and stars will always remain unbridgeable. It is this culture industry and the mythology of economic ascension that the Hollywood system thrives upon. It is only when we reject this blatant form of class warfare that we, the general population, will not succumb to a false sense of ourselves or give a false worth to those manufactured on the silver screen. I can't think of anything more disempowering than to sit in front of a television screen with chips and dip, listening to commentators discuss the hairstyles, dresses, and dates of those who walk the red carpet. Why do I care about these people's lives when I have never met them? Why do we care? They're just fellow human beings who, as people, should be judged like the rest of us on our actions and hopefully on their commitment to social justice. We'll be right back.
I'm
Okay, welcome back. We are going to be talking with Tessos Zomak from South Central Farmers. Tessos Zomak, welcome to KPFK.
Thank you for having me on.
Why don't we start by telling the listeners what is going on at South Central Farmers? What is it? What's its history and what's happening now?
The South Central Farmers is a cooperative of 350 families that are located at 41st and Alameda. There is a community garden there that is 14 acres. That's a lot of real estate in L.A., at least in downtown L.A. And we've been there since basically going on for 13 years, since 1992, just a little bit after the uprisings. And basically, Mayor Bradley mitigated the land to the community after they could not put a trash incinerator in the community. And so the land was basically left for the community to basically have a means to grow food and supplement their basic food intake from people growing their own food in South Central. And so that's basically a little bit about the history of the garden. We've been at struggling for over a year, basically, because the land was originally owned by the city, and then all of a sudden the city decided to sell it to a real estate developer to put warehouses on there. And then all of a sudden, without due process to the people using the resource, made a backroom deal and decided to sell it for very little of what it's worth.
So the land was originally owned by the city, and the incinerator never went through, and then it was basically, it was taken over and in a sense, squatted in and turned into a garden to produce food.
Oh, that's correct. It was actually a program that was started by Doris Block, who's no longer with the food bank, which was right across the street from where the garden is at.
So let's talk a little bit about the garden first. So how big is it?
It's 14 acres, basically two big blocks, large blocks, that a normal city block. It's two of them basically put together with a street running down the middle of them. And it's all fenced in. It's all closed off right now. And then basically it's being used to grow food.
And the number of families represented is over 350.
Right.
So that's amazing.
And then it's been a really successful project for a couple of reasons. One, it has cost the city absolutely basically nothing aside from the land use, okay? Meaning that the people pay for their water that we use. We pay for the, removing the refuse of trash. We do our own cleaning. We pay for our own porta potties. And so in a sense, it's probably one of the most effective projects that the city has ever done, which means they haven't really spent any money doing it. And then it's been very much a grassroots project where the community basically decided there was a need and have decided that this is a way they can solve it.
And how much food is being produced, would you say? Can you estimate that?
Well, I can't talk about the quantity because, people always take a lot of food out of there. But, we could basically say that whatever food is growing there affects an extended family. So, for example, let's say we have 300 families, right, and each one of those families affects another five people. You can clearly see that this number rises close to 10,000 people. Now, we grow a lot of specialty items that are not part of the American fauna, which means that you don't find them in the market. And so we become a kind of a specialty place for people who come all the way from Arizona, from San Francisco, from Texas, and they know that we exist there, and they go there looking for a particular type of produce that you don't find anywhere else in the States.
And do a lot of these families rely on this food?
They use it to supplement their food intake. And so a lot of the people who live on Vernon, Vernon is the fifth lowest earning per capita in the city of L.A., which means that if people earn about $18,000 a year, after you pay rent, maybe you have $200 a month for the rest of the family. And so this place allows people to say, I can cut a third off my food bill if I grow some food here.
That's amazing. What kind of stuff is being grown?
Well, we have things that people probably don't know, which is papalo, which is like a consumable green, chilacayotes, which are a native type of squash, a kind of a spaghetti squash. We grow the traditional stuff, which is corn and tomatoes, and the winter crops, which are basically chards and broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage. But additionally, we grow things that you don't normally find. A lot, also, they grow a lot of medicinal plants that people use, people who are very low income. And as you know, our medical system is basically nearly disappearing. And people who are always had low income have always dealt with traditional plants to basically deal with ailments. And so there, we have a lot of those kinds of plants that people use not only for cooking, but also serve or double as a form of medicinal plants.
Is this mostly organic or?
It's a combination. Our goal is to be fully compliant with organics, but we do have some training issues where we have to instruct people. It's like, hey, don't use this kind of a product because there's there can be some possible side effects. But because everybody is individual, we don't really have a lot of control over a lot of that stuff. But our goal is to do more education for the people who decide to do their farming there, and to instruct them about what the best way to grow some of the products so that they're healthy for their families.
Alan Minsky, our producer, has a really good question, and that is the quality of the produce, he says, in poor communities is generally subpar, and I imagine the stuff that's being grown there is far better.
Right, and then one of the things that you typically find if you go to one of these large warehouse stores is that, they'll sell a lot of produce, and it's, for example, a good example is a tomato. If you buy a tomato in one of these places, it's all pulpy inside. If you buy a tomato that's freshly cut from the garden, it's almost all liquid inside, and that's the difference in quality. And actually, this is one of the work that the people from the Occidental College have been doing. They're saying, that putting a salad bar in a scoop isn't good enough because the quality of the products still doesn't attract the people. You have to have good, fresh, quality produce to want people to basically consume them. And what a lot of the community around this neighborhood does is that they actually use this place as their market because they know they can find everything fresh. You're seeing people actually cut it for you. And that makes a lot of difference because people, know they're consuming something that hasn't been sitting around in a freezer for 2 weeks.
Right. I want to know actually how the actual production process works. Is there a training for people who don't know how to grow things? Do you have getting people from other communities to come and help out? How does that work?
Well, basically, we have people who have a long history, have been there for 12 years, and what we do, it's much more than just growing food. It's a community. So people share their ideas about how they grow stuff. They educate each other in a sense, and they say, well, how do you grow this? And additionally, from the infrastructure perspective, we provide them classes for like, okay, this is the time that you do this, this is the time that you grow this, and these are the things that work well on this soil, or these are the things that don't work well on this soil. And so, it's kind of more of a community-building project rather than actually, emphasis on growing food. So it's like a small town.
Right, right. Uh-huh. Let's talk about the struggle. Let's talk about where things stand. And I know that there was a problem last year where it was almost shut down.
Right. So last year, actually, yesterday was we would have had an anniversary. Actually, today would be the anniversary of 1 year of basically being surviving and struggling. And the issue came down to the following things, that when the city took the land under eminent domain from the original owner, there's a discussion that there was an implied right of first refusal, which is actually being contested in the courts right now. And additionally, that basically because the city sold the land to itself under Reardon, that constituted the owner having the right to do a right of first refusal. So those are some of the things that we're arguing in the court. Additionally, onto that, we are arguing that lack of due process, meaning that the city did not involve the stakeholders who were directly being impacted by the sale of this particular land to a real estate developer. Additionally, the land is valued between $15 and $20 million, and it was sold back at $5 million. So if to give you a perspective, in 1982, when they originally paid fair market value, the city paid $4.7 million. And in 2003, they sold the land back for $5.01 million. Now, I mean, I'd like to get a piece of real estate like that in L.A., okay, which means there's $15 million missing And, you know, you kind of get a feeling like the things that happened in Iraq. What happened to those $6 billion, right? Well, what happened to the, you know, the $10 million over here? And I think that's one of our other causes in the lawsuit is that it's called a Civil Code Section 526A, which is waste of public funds. So in a sense, we by the city engaging in that contractual agreement, they are depriving the stakeholders or they're incurring a loss on behalf of the stakeholders without us having a say in it. And then we're basically saying, no, we don't want that. And so what we want to happen as a result of this legal situation is that we want to nullify the sale of the land and have the land come back to the public domain again and then move so that we can maybe able to move the land from the city ownership to the Trust for Public Land, meaning that we don't want to end up with the land at the end of the day. We want this project to continue to be something productive for the community, in a sense, to green line the property so that, that nothing else but green can happen on this land.
So what can people do to support?
Well, basically, right now, Jan Perry, who has basically earlier on in her career, she had touted herself as being the green candidate for the city or council district number 9. Clearly, she has demonstrated that she has sided much more with Eli Broad and all of those big housing developments that she's putting on Alameda and on Grand, those big housing development projects. And she has done very little for her community as far as defending the environmental issues. She also additionally touted herself as being the parks person, and we're basically saying that she's basically failed at that job, and I don't see why she should be basically reelected, and that she should, and if she is, that she at least at a minimum needs to do something for her impoverished community other than just servicing her big real estate developers.
Is there a phone number or a website that people can contact you to directly support you?
Mm-hmm. People can go to www.saveourgarden.com.
SaveOurGarden.com.
Uh-huh. And then they can call us at
818-255-1483.
And then if we are successful in the legal case, we want to make sure that we bring it back to the politicians and that we get them to basically say, this is something that's worked for 13 years. How can you tear it up when it's not costing you a single penny? We're not asking you for $10 million to see if something works, like a lot of the typical projects that the city does. This works. It's been gone through the testing. It's empirical data. It's functioning in the community. Don't tear it up.
So please, everybody, go to SaveOurGarden.com. Is there also a march on the 16th? Is that correct?
No, actually, we're having a celebration for this, but I will provide KPFK with a press release on that.
Okay, great.
So people will hear more of that, and then again, give us a call, and we'll inform you about the events that are happening there. But again, we are basically moving forward to try to save this project that's been so successful for the community of South Central.
I want to thank you, Tesso, for joining us on Indie Media On Air.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to encourage everybody to please call 818-255-1483 and go to SaveOurGarden.com and get involved and save this historic, important community garden in South Central Los Angeles.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. We are going to move on to our next topic, and we are joined by Candace from 33 and a Third Books. Welcome to KPFK.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. For those listeners out there who don't know, maybe describe quickly what 33 and a Third Books actually is. It's a collective. And what you're going through right now in terms of the gentrification issues in Echo Park.
Sure. So 33 and a Third is a collective books and gallery space that it's been in Echo Park for about 2 years, providing one of the few remaining places in Los Angeles to get independent media, you know, small press, political books, also to see political art and hear political speakers, and a space for the community where people can get together and interact in a way that is becoming more and more endangered as gentrification comes into Echo Park. I myself, I'm a displaced gardener from the Echo Park Community Gardens that was shut down last year. Anyone who comes to the area, it's very plain to see that real estate prices are going up. You know, more and more people are becoming displaced, and more of the community is being turned to serve the interests of making money and not the community.
So what's actually happening with 33 and a third now?
At the bookstore right now, we are set to renew our lease. And when we signed our contract, we had the option to renew at market rate when we chose to renew. And that's kind of an ambiguity that our landlord is using, exploiting. He wants to double our rent. And we've checked with our neighbors and our colleagues in the community, and it's ridiculous. That's nowhere near market rate. We're already paying above market rate. And we really see this as just, you know, an outright, you know, a maneuver to kind of displace the bookstore, because there's no way that we could pay that rent. So what we're asking people to do is write letters, kind of, you know, putting pressure on our landlord to, you know, honor his contract that we entered in good faith, charge us what is market rate, don't raise our rent, and allow us to continue to serve the community. The collective is 10 members strong. We all share the responsibilities of running the bookstore. No one makes a profit off the bookstore, and it's really just, you know, a space for the community.
I should mention that 33 and a third Books is located at Sunset and Alvarado, and it is a prime location, and it's a great place. I've seen some amazing artwork there and books that is very hard to find in your corporate local bookstores. 33 and a third Books is such a great resource, and it would be a tragic loss to have you get kicked out of there because of this kind of greed and gentrification. I should, you know, the other issue is that next door to you, the Echo Park Film Center just went through a similar struggle, and it really took a massive community response and organizing and letters and pressure to the city council as well as locals in the neighborhood. So I imagine are you doing the same kind of work? And you probably are.
Yes, we're lucky to have great support from the community, and we really have an upbeat look at this. We really feel like if we can unite and get enough pressure put on our landlord, you know, we can remain in the space. We really feel like what he did to our neighbor, the Echo Park Film Center, was unfair, and, you know, in that, and also we feel like what we do will set a precedent for the rest of the community. The harder we fight to maintain a fair rent, the more, you know, we'll kind of hold the line.
The address is 1200 North Alvarado, right?
Yes,
for listeners.
That's correct. And we have petitions in the store. You can come in and sign. We have sample letters that you can pick up to help draft. You know, we have an event actually this Friday that we'd like to invite everyone to, which is about graffiti in the city of Los Angeles. It starts at 7 p.m. It's a perfect opportunity to come by, see the bookstore, and what we provide to the bookstore, or to the community, sorry. You know, things like graffiti, which are, you know, more and more becoming criminalized. You know, we respect those things as art, and we respect that the community has, you know, a relationship to that that you can't find in, like, a corporate bookstore.
What would be an address for people to send letters of support to?
Okay, so everyone get their little pens and papers out. Our landlord is named Abe Oheb, A-B-E-O-H-E-B, and you need to send letters care of Mid Wilshire Management, 3660 Wilshire Boulevard, number 530, and the code for that is 90010.
Okay. That's please send letters of support to Abe Oheb, O-H-E-B, care of Mid Wilshire Management, 3660 Wilshire Boulevard, number 530, area code 90010.
And what we basically want in those letters is, you know, say what the bookstore means to you or why it's important to you, why it needs to stay at that address and in that community, and ask him to do the right thing, honor the, you know, what he said he would do, and rent the space to us at a fair rate, which is the market rate.
And what's your phone number at the bookstore if people wanted to call to follow up information?
The number here is 213-483-3500.
Great. I want to thank you very much for joining us on Indie Media On Air, and I want to encourage everybody to follow through on this information and support 33 and a Third Books. It's a valuable community resource. And please go to the bookstore. The event is Friday at 7 o'clock at 1200 North Alvarado. Candace, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
And we're going to take a brief break. You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara County and on the net at kpfk.org. Welcome back to Indie Media On Air. And next up, we're going to be hearing a talk that was given by Naomi Klein on Iraq last Monday in Venice, California. We're going to listen to this for a little bit, and then we're going to go to phones. And you can call the station at 818-985-5735. This is Naomi Klein in Venice, California last week.
Thank you all for coming here. Happy President's Day. I trust you. It's a good time to gather for us, I think. And I trust you've all taken a little time out of your days to appreciate your president. I know I have. Actually, President's Day is something of a complicated holiday because it was originally supposed to mark Washington's birthday, and then it was combined with Lincoln's birthday, and then Nixon decided that it should celebrate all presidents. So on this President's Day, it seems fitting to reflect on a very well-known quote from Hunter S. Thompson, who took his life last night. In 1972, he wrote this to celebrate his president. "It is Nixon himself who represents that dark, venal, an incurably violent side of the American character almost every other country in the world has learned to fear and despise." So happy President's Day, and goodbye to one of the most savage truth tellers. He left us when we needed him most. Lately, it kind of feels like every day is President's Day around here. A never-ending salute to the commander-in-chief. The worse things get here and in Iraq, the more obedient, the more respectful, the more slavishly devoted to the official story we seem to become. We certainly saw a bit of this devotion and adulation around Iraq's recent elections. And I want to spend some time here tonight trying to counter the official story about what happened in those elections and what it meant. Now that a little of that adulation has worn down, I'm sure all of you saw the incredible images that came out of Iraq on January 30th. The women in veils, waiting in lines for hours, willing to risk their lives, willing to risk being blown up to have their say. And those incredible images of people holding up their purple-dyed fingers and smiling. How rare it is, actually, to see Iraqis smiling at all on American television and American newspapers. Certainly for me, I didn't see people dancing anywhere in the streets when I was in Baghdad for 5 weeks, less than a year ago. And it was so wonderful to see those images. And it was moving. But I was amazed to watch these reports in the U.S. press that what all that dancing and waving and smiling was about was an incredible endorsement of the war, a sort of giant thank you for invading us, George W. Bush. I couldn't help thinking about my maternal grandmother, and some of you who read my most recent column in The Nation may have already heard this story. But my late grandmother had an eyesight problem, and She refused to give up her driver's license because, you know, it was the key to her independence. And she sort of knew her way around Philadelphia pretty well, so she could kind of fake it. And this was a problem for the house pets of Philadelphia and mailboxes and things like that that would get in her way. And I have this very vivid memory of watching my father sit down with my grandmother and try to convince her to part with her car keys. I remember this very vividly because she was saying to my father, "Michael, everywhere I go, people are so friendly. They're always waving at me." And I was about 10 years old, and I was watching this, and he goes, "Are you sure they're waving with their whole hand, Gene?" And this left an impression on me because I was 10 and my father was giving my grandmother the finger. So I thought about this while reading a column by one Betsy Hart, a syndicated columnist with Scripps Howard News Service. She described the Iraqi elections like this. She said, "The Iraqi people gave America the biggest thank you in the best way that we could have hoped." And I kept thinking, Betsy, are you sure they're waving with their whole hands? Because we now know the election results. The candidates who were associated with the United States, appointed to the interim government, Iyad Alawi, for instance, got 14% of the vote. Many other U.S. appointees fared even worse. 51% of Iraqis cast their ballots for the slate that was endorsed by Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, who one of his claims to fame is that he's never actually met with anyone representing the U.S. occupation. A central plank of the United Iraqi Alliance platform, which Sistani backed, was that it called for a timetable for the withdrawal of multinational troops from Iraq. That was the second point in the platform, after asserting Iraq's territorial integrity. In other words, Iraqis were not voting to thank President Bush. They were voting to ask him to leave their country. They were definitely not waving with their whole hands. Then there were all the Iraqis who actually didn't vote at all in the elections. Sunnis, who make up roughly 20% of the population, barely voted. Anbar province, where Fallujah is located, had a turnout rate of 2%. Now, some of this was practical because, of course, Fallujah had been leveled and most Fallujans haven't been able to return to their homes. Only 7% of Fallujans have been able to return home, so they couldn't vote. But it wasn't just practical. There was an organized boycott. And the group that represented this boycott is a very respected political organization in Iraq called the Association of Muslim Scholars. And they had a position about the elections, which was not that they were against democracy, as we were told again and again, but that they insisted that there be a timetable for withdrawal before they would participate in the elections, because they were afraid that if they did vote in the elections without a timetable, that their vote would be used to legitimize the occupation, which, of course, has happened. So when you add this together, the 51% who voted for a party whose central plank was get out, and then when you add the 20% who didn't vote because they're so committed to forcing the U.S. out of Iraq, you have a very clear majority of the population saying that at the very minimum, they want a timetable for withdrawal. So, because Bush believes so deeply in democracy, he announced immediately that he was incredibly moved and proud of the Iraqi people, and of course, there would be no timetable for withdrawal. You don't set timetables, he said. In fact, he said that the elections prove that there can be no timetable. Prime Minister Tony Blair called the elections magnificent. He too was moved, but he said that the idea of a timetable was patently absurd. They owed it to the Iraqi people not to set a timetable. And they, of course, were joined by Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice, and yesterday Hillary Clinton, when she came back from Iraq to report that 90 Shias who've been slaughtered over the past 3 days for daring to celebrate Ashura. She said that this was somehow a victory against terrorism because it showed that the terrorists were scared. And she said, of course, we cannot set a timetable for withdrawal. So none of this is treated as a conflict with the general euphoria about the elections, because we're told that the elections were actually not about what people voted for. We're told again and again that what mattered about the elections was that people voted. It was elections as a kind of performance art. It was an emotive experience for Geraldo, who cried. He cried, and he watched himself crying on the air and said, I feel like such a sap. Laura Bush was sort of a proud mom for all of Iraq. She said, it was so moving for the president and me to watch the people come out there with their purple fingers. Now, I mean, there's some way in which this is just an extraordinarily, unspeakably exaggerated version of the crisis in all of our democracies, because, of course, Iraqis aren't the first people to have the distinct experience of voting for one policy and learning that they were getting another. They weren't the first elections to feel like tribal rituals, as Hunter S. Thompson described the Republicans' relationship to democracy. These particular elections did take the global crisis of faith in representative democracy, certainly to new levels, because never have so many risked so much for so little, or so it would seem. And these were the first elections that I've heard of in which it was openly stated that the point was not to set policy, but to risk one's life in order to vote. We heard this a few times, that the point of the election was for the Iraqi people to prove, presumably to Americans, that they wanted to be free. And for Iraqis to show that they can stand up to terror, that they're willing to stand up to terror, that they can look fear in the eye, in the words of John Negroponte, the new spy chief of this country. So it's voting as some kind of endurance test. And I want to look closely at these two points, because they've been extraordinarily powerful and largely unexamined. The first point, this idea of, as George Bush said, that the elections were proof that, quote, the Iraqi people value their own liberty. Stunningly, this appears to come as news to many Americans who were under the impression that Iraqis, until just 3 weeks ago, enjoyed being oppressed. My favorite, I've read a lot of these interviews, but my favorite was this exchange I saw between Anderson Cooper, CNN's Anderson Cooper, and Jon Stewart on The Daily Show. I only caught a little bit of it, but got the transcript afterwards because I was sure I was hearing something. And Anderson Cooper was very moved by the elections, by the way. He said that it was a real turning point for Iraq, and he said, even the bombs sound different. Even the bombs sound different. He was so moved. And so at the end of the interview, Jon Stewart goes, so are you going to go back? And he goes, are you crazy? So I guess the bombs didn't sound all that different. But what really killed me about what Anderson Cooper said was he said, and I thought I was hearing things, he said, it's the first time we've sort of had a gauge of whether or not the Iraqis are willing to sort of step forward and do stuff. I mean, they really haven't been asked to do anything so far. Iraqis have been willing to do stuff to be free for many years. In 1991, at the end of the first Gulf War, tens of thousands of Shias rose up to overthrow Saddam Hussein. They thought the U.S. would back them up, but they were wrong, and they were slaughtered, thousands of them, and they fill the mass graves that are now used as an example of the success of this invasion. But that's only the most dramatic example, and there are many of them throughout Iraq's history. But in the months after this invasion, in 2003, Iraqis proved over and over again that they were willing to do stuff, lots of stuff, to build the democracy that they'd been promised. In fact, in the summer after the invasion, Iraq was seized by an amazing democratic renaissance. There were hundreds of newspapers and political parties that formed across the country. Independent trade unions, which were illegal under Saddam. Only 11 days after the British invaded Basra, workers from the southern oil fields organized the first genuinely independent trade union, the Southern Oil Workers Company, which now has 23,000 members.
You're listening to Indie Media on Air, and we are listening to a talk from Naomi Klein that she gave last week in Venice, California, here in Los Angeles. And we are inviting you to call into the studio, into KPFK, and if you have any comments regarding the talk, the community gardens, or 33 and a Third Bookstore, please call in at 818-985-5735. And now back to Naomi Klein. We'll take your calls in about 3 or 4 minutes.
And Most interestingly, there were these spontaneous elections that happened all through that summer and fall in small cities, towns, and even large cities like Mosul, where they were dealing with the fact that they didn't have water, they didn't have electricity, they had a power vacuum, they had a security vacuum. And so they elected their own councils without asking anybody's permission. They just did it. And they couldn't wait to have democracy. We often hear, you know, this hand-wringing about whether Iraqis are really ready for democracy, whether they've built a culture of democracy, whether they have sufficient civil society to have democracy. And there was a great quote in The Independent about this. There was a young Iraqi said, you know, we've been ready for 35 years. At the first meeting of the Baghdad City Council, the very first item on the agenda was a demand of the occupation authorities that they conduct a census so that they could have national elections. Of course, they needed a census to do that. That was the original plan. The original plan was for the occupation to last just a few months, and Jay Garner, who was the first U.S. envoy, promised to hand over power within 2 months to an Iraqi assembly that would have been elected, not directly elected in a population-wide election, but to have a national assembly that would select a council. And then they would ready the country for elections a few months later. That was the original plan. There was never supposed to be an appointed interim government of Iraq. Even Donald Rumsfeld predicted that the occupation would last just a few months. That's what the Iraqi people were promised. That's what they thought they were going to get. That's what many believed. But somewhere along the line, and this is what the story I'm going to tell you tonight, the plan changed. And the liberators of Iraq turned into occupiers of Iraq, and they started to fight democracy at every turn. And it wasn't a bad plan. It wasn't a mistake. It was that it became clear that if Iraqis actually had the democracy that they'd been promised, they would decide against allowing the U.S. to have military bases in the country. They would decide against the economic goals of the occupation. That's the real story of what has happened in Iraq. And I'm going to try to tell you this story as succinctly as I can tonight. Jay Garner, who was a pragmatist, was replaced after only 3 weeks on the job by Paul Bremer. Paul Bremer was not a pragmatist. He was what the wonderful historian Dilapiro described as a year zeroist. Dilapiro used the phrase year zero because the idea for Bremer's camps and the neocons was that Iraq was going to be rebuilt from scratch. They were going to start over. They weren't going to kind of patch it together and figure it out and do anything even remotely imperfect. They were just going to wipe the slate clean and start over. April 9th, 2003, the day Baghdad fell, is day one of year zero. And if you understand this idea, you understand a lot of the attitudes around the destruction of Iraq coming from the White House.
Welcome back to Indie Media on Air, and we're going to take some calls and take some questions or comments, mostly comments if you have any. And just to give out the number real quick, it's 818-985-5735. Our first caller on the line is Mary. Mary, welcome to KPFK.
Thank you. I'd like to suggest that everyone who supports the Iraqi election gesture that we wear a purple ring on our middle finger.
Now, that's a good idea.
From here on out. Thank you.
Oh, thank you for your comment.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Next is Orlando. Welcome to KPFK.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. One of the things that the occupying government, the U.S. did in Iraq was to do something that they're doing here in the United States, which was to abolish unions. There's very low employment there in Iraq because Halliburton and Bechtel have to get their contracts and keep the people from making money. I mean,
absolutely.
Making money, yeah.
You know, in fact, Naomi Klein wrote a really good article last year about the details of that and how the U.S. has systematically prevented workers from organizing in any way, shape, or form, as well as controlling how businesses get sold and how people make money. And unfortunately, we couldn't hear the entire talk of last week's talk in Venice, but I believe she gets into that as well.
Yeah, well, what seems pretty apparent is that the slavery paradigm is still alive and well with globalization, whereby in an earlier program today that the speaker was talking about how the jobs move from place to place to place where they can get the lowest salaries and for the stockholders to make money. And actually, Wall Street was a former slave block, auction block. So it seems that slavery paradigm is very strong even today.
No doubt. And, you know, it's not a coincidence that American jobs are being exported to many countries around the world where people are being exploited, you know, in very gross violations of human rights and conditions in many parts of the world. So, yeah, it's an exportation of this, exploitation.
Well, it's wonderful that KPFK is on the air and getting the word out and keep doing the wonderful job that you're doing.
Thank you. And Orlando, thank you very much for calling in on the show to Indie Media on Air and KPFK.
Thank you.
Thanks. Bye. Our next caller is Joe in San Fernando. Joe, welcome to KPFK.
Yeah, hey, how's it going?
Good.
Yeah, excellent shows. Two questions. One for Indie Media. Wondering, Indie Media puts out such good information. If you have anything in print, like a newsletter or a newspaper that you put out, and especially stuff that covers consensus decision-making, which, you know, confronts hierarchy, which I think is a form of slavery and domination, and et cetera. And then my question, if I can, for the regarding the garden, the garden issue, community garden, or just a suggestion, I'm wondering if there is a regular farmer's market or anything that the public can come and access the produce or purchase the produce and visit the gardens or tours, and then also if there is any one group representing them that has a legal fund or that is helping to organize them, I think, or any business involving the garden which would help empower them also.
Great, thanks. Well, you know, I can answer a few of those. I think the first way to answer the last question is go to saveourgarden.com because they're going to have the most direct information in regards to the community garden issues. Of course, there's farmers markets all over the city too. Might be able to find some information there. In regards to Indie Media, they are the most regular newspaper or newsprint that's been put out by Indie Media is in New York City, nyc.indiemedia.org. It's called The Independent. You can check that out online at nyc.indiemedia.org. And as regarding consensus decision-making, there's many resources online for that. In fact, local killradio.org has regular consensus trainings that people are welcome to come to. Their meeting's on the 1st and 15th of every month at the Echo Park Film Center at 8 o'clock. I think that was the most of the questions, but we'll move on to our next caller, which is Fifi in Los Angeles. I think that's right.
Look, man, this war about Iraq, the one thing that is so kind of mentally deranged is when people talk about democracy. I see they're talking about, it's sort of democracy has become synonymous with one religion. I mean, democracy, I don't know what that means, and I don't think anybody knows what that means. I think democracy that is being used in the name of the American people is to push this neocons idea of world domination. Because how can you go about spreading democracy when you yourself, you know very well you're not democratic? As was pointed out by Putin the other day, when they asked him about this, George Bush was trying to lecture him about democracy, he said, well, first of all, you have to think about your country whereby the populist vote does not win an election. It is the electoral college that wins elections. Which, of course, is true. If you look at the world, this is the only country that kind of standard is being used. So going to Iraq saying we're pushing for democracy, number one, it cannot be today. Democracy is something that evolves. It has something to do with people's culture. What is true for the Western world cannot be true for the rest of the world. So what we should do is to find a way whereby we all can live peacefully and and happily together instead of pushing your own ideology on people. This whole thing about Iraq's election, it's a fact. We all know that. It's soon enough to part in Iraq.
Fifi, we got about 30 seconds to wrap up, but go ahead.
The Sunnis didn't take part of the did not take part in the elections. How can you say it's democracy? It cannot be a democracy because America itself and all these other Western countries, they are not democratic at all. I think you have a plutocratic government all over the world where whereby the rich are trying to suppress the poor. That's all it is. Democracy is just something they're obsessed with for people that don't know. It never existed. It will never exist.
Thank you so much for your call, Fifi.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to move on to our last caller. And I couldn't agree with you more. Democracy is a code word, and it's a nice word to use for a lot of things, and when in fact it doesn't represent that at all. Linda in South Pasadena, welcome to KPFK.
Hi.
And we got about 30 seconds, so
okay, let me just say that I was at the speech that Naomi gave, and too bad you couldn't play the last part, because what she said was a word to the anti-war movement in terms of what can be done to support the Iraqis in this situation, and that is to support four or five points. Number one, say no to the occupation. Number two, make a request for massive war reparations. Number three, to not be bound by these Bremer laws, which really constrict the whole nation of Iraq, not to be bound by debts. And the fourth or fifth, depending on how you count these.
Okay, we got to wrap up.
Unprofitable, to make war unprofitable and deny them the spoils of war through boycotts
and
other actions.
Thank you so much for that. That's really important. The full speech will most likely be on KPFK shortly, and you can get a copy from Global Voices for Justice. Thanks for listening to Indie Media on Air. Thanks to Alan Minsky, our producer, and Maggie LaPique, and the engineer. Thanks for listening. Be back.
You've been listening to Indie Media on Air, heard Mondays from 3 to 4 on community-based KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara, and at kpfk.org for the world. The Voices from the Frontline edition of the 4 o'clock report is coming up next. Stay tuned to hear more progressive, independent radio.